the true self, in more theological language, Merton talks about, it's essentially Christ. Your true self is Christ. Your true self is the Christ within. And so in Galatians 2, Paul says, I am no longer I, but Christ who lives in me. And that's that Christ, that's the inner self.
Chad Thralls is a scholar of Christian spirituality and mysticism who teaches at Seton Hall University. His primary area of focus is the contemplative spiritual life, and today we discuss his book, Deep Calls to Deep, Mysticism, Scripture, and Contemplation. I'm Matthew Wickman of BYU's Faith and Imagination Institute. Chad Thralls, it's good to see you today. Thanks for coming on here to talk with me.
It's good to see you, Matt. Thanks for the invitation.
My pleasure. So you and I know each other through our involvement with the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality, or SSCS, which is an academic organization. Now, my path to that society is perhaps a little unusual, right, in that I'm a literature professor, and the SSCS is not one of the professional organizations that has a whole lot of presence in literary studies. I'm going to assume, Chad, that your path to the SSCS is less eccentric than mine, okay? Still, I wonder whether that path that you took to the formal study of spirituality was a direct one, or whether in its own way it's got its own kind of meandering quality.
So my path is much more direct. I had a wonderful spirituality professor in my master's program, Glenn Henson, and he directed me to the PhD program in spirituality at Catholic University. And my advisor had on his bookshelf a collection of all the spiritus issues that had been released at that point. I attended my first SSCS meeting in 2003 in Atlanta at the AAR.
Okay, That's when Spiritus was actually... So Spiritus is the journal, the flagship journal for the Society of the Study of Christian Spirituality, and it was not that old at that point. So you've been in the... What, that's 20 years now?
I guess so. If you hang around long enough, you get to be on the podcast, I guess.
Well, I wanted to have you on the podcast because you wrote this really terrific book, published a couple of years ago, titled Deep Calls to Deep, Mysticism, Scripture, and Contemplation. And I find this to be a really great book, Chad. It's clear, it's concise, it's helpful, it's very thoughtful. Published by Orbis Books, which is an excellent publisher for Catholic theology. I'm curious, you know, why you wrote the book and for whom, right? For what kind of reader?
So the mystical tradition of Christianity has been so life-giving to me. It's like the treasure hidden in the field in Matthew 13. And so there's so much riches there, so much in terms of practice and images and metaphors that really give so much life to something that can, you know, if you watch the news, not be terribly life-giving. So I wanted to write the book to make this seemingly, based on its lack of public knowledge, sort of esoteric side of the tradition, this element that's always been there. It's like the redbud trees that are just this faint purple hue, that this undercurrent that's there, that's just not appreciated. And so I wanted to make it more accessible. There's been such great work over the last generation by Bernard McGinn and others you've had on your podcast who've done such great work to bring that scholarship to a wider audience. So that was my goal. It's not necessarily breaking, it's not a monograph like McGinn's, but it's sort of directed to students and to lay people who can benefit from the riches, the treasure that's buried in the tradition that's not well known enough.
That's a great reference to Matthew 13, that treasure hidden in the field, because there is so much in the tradition, I completely agree, that is so rich and so great. And I love about your book the fact that it is speaking in very clear ways to people about a subject that often seems obscure, right? Mysticism. Your point is that it's not so obscure as that. It's a spiritual practice that can be accessed by lots of people. And you do a great job setting that up. I mean, really terrific. Let me ask you about something you write in the book's introduction. You state, I'm quoting you here, "The point of being religious and belonging to a religious community is to cultivate awareness of the presence of God and to be transformed by that encounter. Okay, you also observe, however, that in our era is one in which many institutional religions are in decline, and you remark, I'll quote you again here, that this is due in part to religion being distracted from its main purpose, connecting with the divine. When religion is used to divide people or is reduced to a political platform, many conclude that its primary purpose has been abandoned. Okay, this is a really important point, very relevant to our current era. In your view, is religious decline due to its divisiveness, or is divisiveness a product of religious decline, a kind of a closing the ranks, or do those two things kind of feed off each other?
I don't know that I can tease it out specifically, but what I would say is that most people today are finding their identity not from their religious identity, but from their political identity. That's where people's identity is coming from today. And so they are understanding who they are by who they are not. We are not those people over there, the people that support these things that we don't. And so this is the identity. And so if that's your identity, you are circling the wagons and you are against fundamentally. That's your fundamental understanding of who you are. You're against something else or another group. And so in that sense, I think that the decline of religion as an identity has led to, well, if that's not my identity, then it's something else. And my something else identity is that I'm against those people over there. And that's just, as we all know, led to dark, sad places in our culture right now.
Yeah, it sure has. I see that even in my own religious community. I mean, I think that in my religion, the communities are fairly tight-knit, which is a nice thing about them. But even, it's like in a family. You can have like strife in a family. I find that in a lot of our wards or smaller kind of local communities, there is this sense that politics drives a lot of people's primary identities. And if you don't have the same affiliation as people across the aisle, across the pew, this can cause, some friction. So I think that's exactly right, what you say. Now, you mention that mindfulness has become a popular spiritual practice among the so-called nones. That's N-O-N-E-S, right? These are people who have left institutional religion but still have an interest in spiritual life. And yet, right, as you recognize, is an important point, and this I'm going to quote you again from your book. Instead of utilizing mindfulness to understand the causes of our mental suffering and the suffering caused by the institutions in which we participate, mindfulness, is often used simply as a technique to calm the self and become more productive at work. Consequently, it can easily become a tool to promote individualistic consumerism. Okay, that's a really, really good point. And you claim this is not true, though, of mysticism in the way that you're trying to characterize it. So what's the defining difference between kind of mindfulness that's kind of subject to consumeristic appropriation and mysticism, which is not?
So I think that it's possible that if you were a committed mindfulness practitioner, that this wouldn't be the case. But I think that in general, the way mindfulness is presented is about becoming more efficient as an athlete or as a worker or as an employee. Rather, a religion, whether Buddhism, Christianity, or any other religion, it embeds you in a narrative. And the narrative is that it's not all about you. It's not all about me. And so this narrative, for instance, one of my favorite metaphors in the New Testament is the body of Christ in 1 Corinthians 12, and that we are part of a body. It's not just me. It's not just me optimizing my own life and making sure everything works out perfectly. And it's more about my connection to this greater group. And it's not just this, my local church community. It's the political community. It's my neighbor. It's people who are different from me and different tribes. It's the natural world. It's about developing this. It's seeing the self as, rather than a narrow thing, as an expansive thing that's included in everything. And so I think that's where I would go with that. Yeah.
Okay. That metaphor, the body of Christ, is really crucial because it's all about there in 1 Corinthians 12, the importance of each member to the other, right? That no member can function as an independent contractor, You know, it might be nice if I could sort of have my hands go do somewhere else, where I'm somewhere else, they could take care of it, like the work, the yard work outside, but I'm inside doing something I'd rather do. That would be good, but it doesn't work that way. And is that when, and the problem is, I think, a lot of these modern spiritual practices that are disconnected from religion, as kind of the, I mean, it really is kind of independent operation, and which is difficult, I think, to achieve some of the kinds of effects of this transformative understanding of the nature of God that you're trying to get to. You define mysticism by way of the really important scholar Bernard McGinn as the cultivation of a deep and transformative awareness of the presence of God. And you define this awareness less as an object of knowledge, right? It's not like a thing you study scientifically. And it's more like the knowledge that one spouse has toward the other or anybody close to someone like them. So that you liken mystical understanding to a process or a journey or a way of life, getting to know somebody as you go. I'm curious about something here, and this is a really important point. You make the case that mystical knowledge need not be only for those who live a monastic life. It can be for everyone. And you use this basketball analogy, which I loved. Can you elaborate on this? Right. So that these two kinds of knowledge, A, it's not scientific, it's more about more relational, and B, it need not be only for those who are dedicated monastics.
Yeah, I can't take credit for the basketball analogy. That's Bernard McGinn also, although my students love it. I think for people like us, spirituality is something you study, and there are ideas and concepts, and you can talk about them. But I think spirituality primarily, at its most fundamental level, is about experience. And so just because I haven't had the experience of Teresa of Avila or some other or great mystic doesn't mean that it's about individuals. Like, I play basketball, for instance, at my university at lunchtime, and there are no college scouts coming to watch me play, but that doesn't mean that I don't enjoy playing. And so it's about the experience of the practice, the everyday practice of the faith. And that is, and that looks different for different, there are different practices. I mean, for me, in the book, I talk about the sort of the slow meditative reading of scripture, what they call Lectio Divina, and contemplative prayer, contemplation, centering prayer. And so those are the practices that I sort of talk about in the book, but there are lots of other practices of just living the ordinary Christian life day to day. And so that's what it's about to me. More so, it has to be about that before it's about the ideas that we talk about, which are awesome and great, but they are a product of this lived experience.
Yeah, great. We had Stephanie Paul Sell on here a couple weeks ago, and she was talking about Lectio Divina, you know, contemplative reading practices, and making
great episode,
point,
by the way.
Well, thank you very much. She's terrific. And enjoyed that conversation. But she talks about this is not a practice just for those who are, you know, consecrated and set apart, you know, in some kind of desert setting. You know, really can be for everybody. And it's for everybody, and yet I wouldn't say, your book doesn't suggest that it's easy or simple either. It's not like the kind of thing you can even do casually necessarily. And one of the manifestations of the kind of the rigors of the mystical life are the ways that we even speak about God. It's kind of it's not easy to do, right? So you mentioned that we use metaphors often when we describe our experience of God, and we appeal, and why we appeal to metaphor in the first place. Now, I'm a literature professor, literature geek, right? So my ears prick up when someone talks about metaphor. So what are some of these metaphors that we use, and why do we appeal to metaphor in the first place in talking about the mystical life?
Great question. So there are two main types of language that the mystics use. One is apophatic language, which says that God is ultimately a mystery and we really don't know. I mean, there's no language that's up to the challenge of talking about this unknowable mystery. But the other is a cataphatic language, which uses metaphors to try to give us a glimpse, a taste, a facet of the mystery. And so I think that metaphors are some of my favorite ways to talk about it, because we have to talk about it. We're compelled to talk about it. So if we do, we have to use metaphors are the most interesting way to do so. I'm a huge fan of Martin Laird, who and his work on contemplation uses metaphor exquisitely. And so I am completely and utterly inspired by Martin's work. I like to play with it myself. I gave a talk recently, and I can't take credit for all of these, but some of my favorite metaphors are biblical metaphors are great, but one of my favorite metaphors is the snow globe. And if you're talking about contemplation, normally when our lives aren't centered and calm, and so the shaken up snow globe to me is a great metaphor for what contemplation that our normal minds are like, because our normal minds are swirling with thoughts. But if you let that snow globe rest for a while, eventually those snowflakes will come down to the bottom and the water will become clear. I gave a talk recently for a church in New Jersey, and there's a lot of commuters in this community. And so I talked about, to me, the one way to talk about the difference between the contemplative mind and the ordinary mind is the difference between in my daily commute. I commute from Manhattan to New Jersey, and so I go through Penn Station every day that I go to New Jersey. And if you ask New Yorkers what their most despised place in the city, it would probably be Penn Station. now that LaGuardia has been renovated, it's now Penn Station is the least desirable place. But they have built, Matt, since you've lived here, they have built a new Amtrak entrance. The Moynihan Train Hall is across 8th Avenue from Penn Station. So Penn Station is underground and has low ceilings and sort of these maze-like cavern ways of meandering through the station.
Yep.
Moynihan, on the other hand, is above ground and has glass ceilings and is full of light and has art installation. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. And so I think that Penn Station, to me, is a good illustration of what the mind can be like if we don't keep watch over it, our ordinary mind. Whereas Moynihan, to me, is the contemplative mind. It's the spacious, it's the vast, gorgeous. I mean, I don't know how tall the ceiling is in Moynihan, but it's several stories. It's beautiful.
Nice.
My wife is from Colorado, and so when I go out there, I don't get to Utah enough. I apologize, but I do get to Colorado frequently. And as a person who's raised on the East Coast, driving in Colorado to me feels like the contemplative mind, in that there's a valley that when we're driving west. She lives 4 hours southwest of Denver. Her family does, and so there's a valley we drive through, and I think the mountains are 25 miles apart and the peaks are over 10,000 feet. And it couldn't be any more different than driving on the East Coast, where they normally have trees lining the interstate highways. Whereas it's just wide and vast. And so these metaphors sort of help describe and evoke what the contemplative mind feels like when you've put in the practice over many seasons or years on the cushion, as I say in Zen.
Yeah, that resonates with me. I remember my first time in Manhattan. I was going off for grad school. This is years and years ago. And I remember driving in a taxi from JFK into the city. And I'm from Southern California, you know, and in very wide freeways and lots of traffic and just lots of, it's huge, but it's kind of very horizontally, laterally huge, you know, unlike Manhattan, which is just so big and vertical. And I remember we were driving on these narrow little like freeways, you know, kind of curving in and out, up and down little hills, tiny up and down, and not much vision of what's out and around. But suddenly we rounded a corner and suddenly there was all of Manhattan sort of sprawling out. And I thought, wow, I was overwhelmed with the urban sublime. It was like this... a city, like a mountainscape, but in city form, And in a way, I mean, that would be another kind of metaphor here for contemplative life, you know, kind of the everyday, you can't see much, you're bound up with local concerns. And suddenly, though, you find a way to just kind of calm, open onto some kind of different way of thinking, and something bigger appears to view. So even New York has got its own kind of Colorado-esque quality. You can sort of see it in the right light, I guess, in a way. Let me ask you, you move from mystical experience, well, of our understanding of God vis-a-vis mystical experience, and ask you about how it relates to understanding of ourselves, right? You write that the true self is not a thing, it's an experience. And I find this provocative, right? This idea of self less as an object than an experience. Can you elaborate on what that means, self as experience, and perhaps what its implications are for how we live or understand ourselves?
Yeah, I teach undergraduates, and so when I was an undergraduate, I thought that I was supposed to be digging into myself to find out what I was meant to do, and so I guess I thought of the self as something that you were mining for, you were like introspectively searching for. But I think that this idea of the true self, it kind of comes from Thomas Merton's distinction between the true and the false self, or the inner self and the external self. And so I think his understanding of the true self, the inner self, it's not about introspectively finding this core of the core of the person, but it's more about, are you present in what you're doing? Because normally we're not. Normally our minds are filled with, I wish this was different. I'm not satisfied with what's happening right in front of me, so I'm going to try to control my circumstances to make sure things work out the way I want them to. I just don't like this. But there are some times when we're reading a good book, or we're just simply washing the dishes and seeing them. Like brushing my teeth sometimes. Like, do you ever think about brushing? You're actually, the fact that you're brushing your teeth when you're brushing them. I mean, just simple things like that. I think that there are so many things that people have talked about, whether it's motorcycle maintenance or washing dishes or just being present in what you're doing, that in sports, they talk about being in the zone. When you're in the zone, which feels great, I'm not thinking about the stuff I have to do this afternoon. I'm just like, I'm right there. And so I think that the true self is not, I'll add a qualifier here. I talk about this in two different contexts, right? I teach a regular, just regular undergrad required classes. And in that sense, I talk about it's you being present in what you're doing, not worried, not anxious, just right here. You saw the oak tree in the garden. You noticed the person in front of you that's having a bad day. Your friend's having a bad day, and you ask them about it. You show concern. But I think that the true self, in more theological language, Merton talks about, it's essentially Christ. Your true self is Christ. Your true self is the Christ within. And so in Galatians 2, Paul says, not I, but I am no longer I, but Christ who lives in me. And that's that Christ, that's the inner self, I think. I think that's what we're talking about.
Okay, which is not always easy to access, that Christ that lives in oneself, because we get in our own way, right? We are prone to distraction. I mean, so much of your book is about kind of getting away from these kinds of distractions, and becoming present and really aware. And in that kind of setting, one can become then more attuned, right, to these other aspects, these more core elements to who we are. And that great passage from Galatians, right? Not I, but Christ in me. That's really part of that, really crucial to that idea. Now, let me ask you about a passage that resonates with me in your book, but where my own religious tradition often talks about it a little bit differently. I'm curious, this guy, moment of interfaith dialogue here, I guess. Here's what you write. I'm going to quote you here. You write, following the mystical path is not about cultivating pleasant experiences. These are fine in themselves, but they are not the goal of contemplative practice. They are winsome side effects of the process of letting go of self that we do well not to get attached to. Likewise, the contemplative path is not about achieving or gaining something like a credential or even the title of mystic. Instead, after many seasons of practice, we realize no external self remains to collect the accolade. All right. I really like your observations here, and they resonate with me, and yet I'm curious how you respond to what my own religion teaches. And here we may differ, maybe we don't. People in my faith community would say that mystical experiences, or as we call it, experiences with the Spirit of God, are usually given for our profit and learning. There's a purpose why they're there. They bring us closer to God. They testify to things that are true. They provide direction. They deepen our capacities. They can act on us in a variety of dynamic ways. But they all do so with the purpose of leading us closer to God and helping us become better disciples of Christ, right? This is why God grants these experiences. They are in their very nature purposeful, right? This is how we tend to talk about them. Does that idea of that kind of purposefulness resonate with you, or is that still too instrumental, still too bound up in an expectation for what they yield that you'd push back against?
I like it on a certain level. I think that, you know, it's great. But my concern, though, is that if you're doing it to get the experience, you're still the center of the attention. You're still on center stage. And so I think the goal of the contemplative journey is to loosen the grip of self. Another metaphor I like is that I like to look at the sky. And so I am the blue sky. I'm not the clouds. So the clouds are all of my, you know, I have to do this. I'm worried about this. My son got injured at soccer practice. You know, whatever. You know, so it's all the thoughts, the worries, the anxieties, the to-do list. And part of that can be sort of enhancing my own thought, either my own reputation among others or just my own impression, my own sense of progress in my own journey. And so I think that they certainly have a place, and I think that that is a very practical sort of way of looking at it. But at the same time, I would want to point toward a more loosening the grip of self. And Martin Laird likes to say, sometimes we find ourselves the center of our own contemplative project, which I think is genius. And so we want to be sort of nudged off the center of the stage. And so I think that's, to me, that's the goal to work for.
Yeah. See, that's why what you had to say resonated with me also, right? And on the one hand, like, I do believe that these experiences can bring us closer to God, that they, I think that God grants them for reasons, not just arbitrarily, but they're often, like, it needs to direct our attention to something or other. I think that's true. But on the other hand, you know, when you do put yourself at the center of your own contemplative practice, you can really distract yourself, right, from what it is that's actually moving you, and you kind of close yourself off to all of what that experience might yield. Right. In other words, becoming so fixated on what this thing did for me is precisely the way to sort of cut yourself off from it. There's a paradox in there, but I think that kind of reconciling that paradox is part of what it means to become more attuned to spiritual life. Right. So this is why what you said, I think, also really, to me, had a lot of power, and it rang true to my own experience. Sometimes just sitting quietly in the presence of God's Spirit is the point, and not to get something specific from that experience, right? What it's for reveals itself over time and not just in that moment. Something else that I love about your book is how it describes our need to cultivate inner dispositions that make it easier for us to access the divine. And you mentioned things that I find personally difficult. Okay, so for example, learning to see non-judgmentally, learning how to accept the world around us, learning how not to categorize other people. These judgments are so reflexive in us, right? It's just, they're so natural. Can you explain these features of a mystical life, why they're important? And what would you say to the comeback that would say, oh yeah, yeah, but Chad, learning to judge properly is essential to a spiritual life? How would you kind of reconcile that?
Yeah, so I think that the mind generates thoughts involuntarily, and a lot of these are you too are you Are you too cold? Are you too warm? Do you appreciate the person's attire that you pass on the sidewalk? Are you do you appreciate the whatever it is in front of you? We have an opinion. We just secrete opinions about everything around us. And in terms of your concern about being able to use judgments effectively as a human, it's necessary. I had a student, I teach Christian mysticism in the spring, and I had a student this semester who, at the end of the second week of this, she said, you know, I feel like we've gotten into this a little bit. I'm a little concerned that we haven't talked about love of neighbor yet, which seems to me to be the point of Christianity. And I assured her that we would talk about that toward the end of the semester, but that if your mind is occupied by thoughts, then you're not, you don't have the clarity of mind or the purity of heart to be able to judge effectively. If your mind is full of your own thoughts, you won't be able, your help of your neighbor will be help that makes you look good or the help that you think they need rather than what they actually, something that actually helped them. So.
Okay. You know, this reminds me, I, for a while in my own religious community, I had a leadership position, and I served with somebody who was the president of a small college. And it's a church college. And he would say that, I asked him, you know, kind of, you know, how'd you manage this? He said, well, I tried to learn how to get out of heaven's way. That was his, you know, and he was being in some ways modest. He's a very able leader. But his point was, we get in the way of things when we try to bring too much of our own wisdom, our own thinking into them. Right. And then applying that here to what you're saying, you know, kind of getting out of heaven's way is to say, you know, don't say to yourself, you know, I'm setting out to do this good thing or that good thing, because that very intensity of focus can also limit us to other things that may be communicated to us by God. It's about being open. It's learning how to be open, learning how to recognize what opens us, blue sky, versus what clouds us, you know, your reference to clouds, right? Which is really important. You know, you conclude your book, speaking of clouds now and sky and this kind of thing, you conclude your book with a chapter on the natural world, right? On the way that mystical life connects us with, rather than divides us from, the natural world. So many scholars that I know in this field of spirituality studies are also eco-theologians. What led you to make this connection to the natural world, and indeed, what led you to make it your book's ultimate chapter?
Yeah, I think that when I am in, so continuing the theme of thoughts, so I think that your thoughts are the way that you cause yourself to suffer. We induce our own mental suffering through the thoughts that we allow to rattle around. And so when I'm in nature, my thoughts release much more easily. It's like I've used this metaphor of like it's like a soda bottle. When you open up the soda bottle, all these you realize, I mean, everybody knows this, but there's all the carbon dioxide bubbles are trapped in that bottle. And staying indoors all the time keeps those thoughts inside my head. But going outside, especially in a place under the trees, somehow facilitates the releasing of those bubbles. I grew up in West Virginia, and so it's pretty easy access to nature. I've lived in cities for a long time now. When I first moved to New York, I was teaching at Fordham and lived in the Bronx. Fordham's campus is right beside the New York Botanical Garden. And so I visited the New York Botanical Garden every single week that I lived in the Bronx, rain or shine, snow or whatever. And there's just, and it wasn't at first a conscious choice. It was like a magnet pulling me there. So I walked in Central Park this morning. I live very close. And so there's something, just holy and healing that I feel differently, frankly, if I'm in a more open space than not. My son is 8, and so if I'm walking him to school, or I'm walking him to an appointment, or walking him to the grocery store, I intentionally walk through the park or through a block that has an open space of the building. So there's something, to me, it's about practice. And there's lots of different angles into the eco-theology realm, but I think it starts for me in just how it makes me feel. And it makes me feel it makes me feel alive and at peace in a way that just walking on regular streets in New York don't.
Yeah, yeah. And there's something very restorative about the natural world. And of course, we live at a time, kind of a post-industrial age, when on the one hand, we're so cut off, right, from the natural world. On the other hand, we're aware that our being cut off is causing all kinds of really important problems.
Yeah,
you know,
of course,
I mean, and that are going to require a lot of work to try to heal and solve. And spirituality certainly is one way to become more attuned, I think, to our surroundings, and that would include, perforce, the natural world. Let me end this conversation this way by asking you this, but your book that you've written, Deep Calls to Deep, is an excellent overview of mystical life. And I'm wondering what a follow-up project to a book like this one is for you. Right? I suppose you could hone in on one aspect of mystical life. You might address other facets of mystical life, or you could turn your attention to something totally different, right? What do you imagine is next for you?
Wow, it's the big question. I do most of my writing in the summer. So this summer I have two sort of articles in mind. We'll see if there's enough time to get to them. When I moved to New York, I was given a class at Fordham called Meditation East and West. And I'd taught world religions before, but I hadn't taught Buddhism to graduate students. And so I was looking for a guest speaker, and I was lucky to find a guest speaker in New York who was also a Zen teacher, a Catholic priest who was also a Zen teacher. So I've been sitting in his Sangha for 12 years or so. So one article I want to write this summer is sort of a comparison of a Christian mystic and a particular Zen master, and how they're talking about the contemplative mind. So that's sort of one project I have. That's a little comparative theology that interests me. I guess I'm putting this out into the world then. So I am interested. One of the things I like about Christian spirituality is that it's not just historical, and that I teach the history of Christian mysticism and the history of Christian spirituality, and that those are great. But my experience also matters. You've had Douglas Christie and Bill and Lane on your podcast, who I think are absolute masters of this. How their own life relates to these texts and how these texts illuminate. I have been inspired by their work for years. I think that the current world of academia gives a certain experience depending on where you are in the hierarchy. And so I am a teaching fellow. I am not on the tenure track. And so how do the mystics offer resources that help me survive in this sort of career purgatory place that I find myself? That's another project that I'll be tackling this summer. So, and now that I've said it on this podcast, I have to do it.
May it be so. You know, both those things sound really compelling to me, Chad. I think they'd be really good projects. So best of luck with both, with all your work, you know, and life generally. You are very generous to come on here and talk with me. Thank you for your thoughtfulness, your wisdom, and your really lovely work. Appreciate it so much.
Well, thank you for your interest, and thank you for this podcast. Your interest and generosity to all of the different guests is humbling, and I just want to compliment you for that. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.